You're going to have to bear with me. My voice has been playing games with me. So back in 1858, the Illinois legislatures played what was considered to be a very tricky or a dirty trick in politics. They had taken the Senate seat that had been won by popular vote and had given it to someone who the legislature decided to give, ignoring the will of the people. And so the seat went to Stephen Douglas when it was supposed to have gone to Abraham Lincoln. Now, I love the words of Lincoln when he was asked by a newspaper reporter how he felt about it. Listen to what he said. He said, "Like the boy who stubbed his toe, I am too big to cry and too badly hurt to laugh." I love that, honestly. Too big to cry and too badly hurt to laugh. That's a good definition of what it feels like when we feel and encounter rejection. Too big to cry and too hurt to laugh. It's interesting when you think about rejection. Rejection is something that it dogs us all of our lives, doesn't it? Early on in life, even in the playground, when all of a sudden, as young children, we're introduced to competition, which is acceptance by performance. And all of a sudden, we begin to feel that wave of not being enough, not being acceptable. And it continues to dog us. To that point when early in our school years or in our adolescence, we come to that place where we dig up the courage to ask for our first date and hear the words, no. Or later when we apply for college admission and we get that wonderful, tactful denial. And it just keeps on going to the first jobs that we apply for or the promotions that we were sure were in the bag for us and they were given to somebody else. And of course, later in life, the tragedies that can happen in divorce when all of a sudden we find that our spouse now has an attraction for someone else and nothing but rejection for us. Rejection is painful stuff. It's one of the hardest things of life. As we began our series last week looking at the hardest things of life, the hardest things to deal with, the hardest things to engage in. This morning, I want to talk about rejection because rejection is just that. It is something that very shortly after we come into this world, we encounter. And it is something that grows and grows and grows and dogs us at every turn. The rejection of divorce, the rejection of our children later in life, the rejection of people that we thought were good and close friends. The impact that can have on us. This morning, I want to look at that, and as we look at the scriptures, I want to see how the scriptures deal with it, and particularly how the scriptures would have us to deal with it. If you have any doubts about what a fearful thing rejection is, listen to the results of a study by a researcher by the name of Guy Wench, who just recently brought together some great research on rejection and the power of rejection. Listen to what he says. He says, number one, rejection piggybacks on physical pain pathways in the brain. MRI studies show that the same areas of the brain become activated when we experience rejection as when we experience physical pain. Why is it that we run from rejection? Why is it that as little kids, after a few tastes of it, we begin to say, I don't want to sign up for Little League, or I don't want to sign up for football, or I don't want to sign up for the play, or I don't want to go on this or that, because once we taste it, we know it's painful. And as Wench says, it literally is painful. The same areas in the brain that register pain register the same thing when we experience rejection. In fact, it's interesting. In his study, what they found when they came across that, they gave people who were experiencing rejection, are you ready for this? Tylenol. And do you know what they found? That their feelings of rejection diminished somewhat. Just like their feelings of pain physically would diminish when giving Tylenol. Now, yeah, that's not the takeaway from this message. Whenever you feel rejection, just take a few Tylenol and call your doctor in the morning. But it is interesting. The proof in the fact that when we experience rejection, there is something physiological that goes on in our brains. He says, our brains have been trained to connect to and fear rejection. They've been trained because early on we have linked rejection to survival. That in many cultures, even today in primitive cultures, if you are rejected by your tribe or your village, it could mean your very life. Now, we don't experience it like that, but it feels like that. In his research, he found that we can relive and re-experience social pain more vividly than physical pain. Think about that for a minute. That's powerful. Can you remember what it felt like when you maybe got your tonsils out when you were a child, or you know, when you broke a bone? You can remember the incident, but can you remember the pain? Probably not. But that's how powerful rejection is, that when you start to think about rejection, when you think about betrayal, man, you can feel that every time. It is something that is more vivid and easily relived in our brains than even physical pain is. He says that rejection destabilizes our need to belong to the point that we begin to soothe rejection by seeking acceptance in any place that we can find it. Why do kids join gangs? Why do adults join gangs? This past summer, for the first time in probably, 40 years or so, I had eye surgery, and so I was on vacation up at Lake Winnipesaukee and went to motorcycle weekend. Just went because I just wanted to see what it was like. And I saw old men. I mean, it was pretty sad. All wearing their biker stuff and all trying to look mean. And I thought, what the heck is behind this? It's a place to belong. Because we live in a world where we are constantly told, we don't belong, we don't belong, we don't belong. And think about it. What a better opportunity for Satan to provide a place to belong and all the places we shouldn't belong. In a study, and this makes sense, we know this innately, rejection causes anger and it causes aggression. In fact, in all the studies that they have done with school shooters, the one thing that they have in common is rejection. About 3 years ago, I was asked to do psychological profiling for school shooters for the FBI and law enforcement in Concord. And I agreed to do it, which was really dumb on my part. Because I agreed to do it, and then I began to do the work, and I found there's no profile. There's too many variables. You can't just point to some things and say, this is what makes up a school shooter. But the only thing I did find was that there are kids who come from homes or schools where they experienced rejection. When we are rejected, when we are cast aside as if we are not enough, we get angry. We all know this stuff. We know what it feels like. We know what it does to us. Enough rejection and we begin to withdraw. Enough rejection and then suspicion begins to creep into our bones. And we look at everyone around us as potential adversaries who are looking to hurt us. And so we deny ourselves the vision of a life worth having. We deny ourselves the willingness, the ability to go out and risk and see that good things can happen. And spiritually, what can happen over time with enough rejection? We take the rejection of those around us and we begin to project it on God. We begin to believe that the consensus of people around us is the voice of God talking to us about how he feels about us. And to the point that we can reject God because of it. Think about people who won't come to Christ. People who refuse God's love. Why would you do that? Why would you refuse the offer of love from anyone? It's because you don't really trust it. You don't really believe that they could love you. That the God of the universe could love you. This morning, we're going to look at this subject, and we're going to look at it from a passage from the Old Testament. From 1 Samuel chapter 18. And I'm going to give you a little bit of background on this passage. Because this passage, in part, is about rejection and what it does to us. So the background of the passage. We have a man by the name of Saul, who is king over Israel. Now, this is a big deal for two reasons. One, because Israel was not supposed to have a king. Israel was a nation loosely bound together by tribes. There were 12 tribes, and each were given judges to kind of deal with problems within the tribes. But God was meant to be their ultimate leader. God was meant to be their king. God was meant to be the sovereign over all of them. And yet, there came a point where the people of Israel said, no thanks, we want a king. And so, it's a big deal when we look at this passage because Saul is the first king of Israel. Now, when Saul was made the first king of Israel, the second important thing about this is that he was appointed by God. God chose him to be king. God spoke through one of the judges, a man by the name of Samuel, and secretly chose Saul to be king even before the people came together and drew lots. That was a way of determining what God's will was, and chose Saul. Now, Saul was also a good choice to the eye. In fact, out of all the tribes, he was considered to be one of the most handsome men in Israel, one of the most strongest men in Israel. And he had already proven himself at different points through the history of Israel to be a mighty military leader. So when God chose him and when the people declared it through choosing of lots, it just seemed like the right thing to do. The problem is, as Saul begins to live his life as king, he does exactly what God had warned the people about. When the people were crying to God saying, we want a king, we want to be like the nations around us, we want to be like the Philistines. The Philistines were those neighbors that were just a nuisance, always seeking to disrupt Israel, always seeking to destroy Israel. And so Israel looked at the Philistines and said, we want a king like them. We want a king who can represent us before the world and show that we're not just a ragtag bunch of people, but that we have our acts together. What they didn't realize is by saying, we want a king, they were looking to dethrone God as their king. See, all of the nations around them had kings, but none of the nations around them had God as their king. And yet, they rejected God so they could have something lesser to rule over them. And so God said, if it's a king you want, it's a king you'll get. But I warn you this. He will not just rule you, he will rule over you. He will lord over you. He will take your money through taxes and he will oppress you. But if that's what you want, then that's what you'll get. And so God appointed Saul as king, and it wasn't long before Saul went south. It wasn't long where he became full of himself and he began to step out of obedience to God, began to worship false idols. He began to even take on the role of a priest, which he had no right to do. If there was a rule to be violated, Saul violated it because he was king. He set himself on high. And so, when God had enough of it, he secretly chose David to be the next king. David, as you know the story of David and Goliath, David was just a little shepherd boy who one day, out of frustration because of the incompetence of the army of Israel, stepped up with a slingshot and took down Israel's most nasty enemy. And after that, Saul recognized that there was something going on with David that he needed for himself. He needed to prop himself up before the people. Now, I want you to just keep this stuff in mind because we're going to see this in a minute. And so that's the background that we enter into when we look at this passage. So I'm just going to ask if we can have that put up there, please. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return home to his family. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing, along with his tunic and even his sword, and bowed and bow and his belt. Excuse me. Whatever mission Saul went on, David was so successful that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the troops and Saul's officers as well. So what do we see taking place? Saul is made king. After a while, Saul begins to wander and drift away from God. He becomes disobedient. He becomes full of himself. He doesn't win the battles he used to win. And now God chooses another to be king. But Saul doesn't know it. And so he takes David in because he sees something powerful in David. Well, what he sees is the power of God. What he sees is a heart for God, a devotion to God. And he sees a man that God has so uniquely equipped. And he takes him in, and what happens? Well, the first thing that happens is his son, Jonathan, admires him, respects him, even develops a deep love for him as a friend. Symbolically lays everything out before David as a sign of, I will even die for you. Now, can you imagine what that must have been like for Saul? All of a sudden, now even my kid is being attracted to this guy. My son, who once admired and respected me, is now showing that admiration and respect and devotion to my underling. And when Saul made him a head of the army, what happens? All the troops rejoice. They love David. They say David is the man. I mean, he was the Norman Schwarzkopf of the time. He was the general that anybody would fall into battle. And not only did the troops love him, but the leaders loved him. The generals loved him. Can you imagine being Saul, watching this beginning to percolate? You're king. You're supposed to be number one. You are divinely chosen by God, and yet you're watching it slip through your fingers. What was he experiencing? You're starting to begin to experience rejection. But look what we see. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the woman came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing and joyful songs. Well, that doesn't sound bad. I mean, obviously, yeah, his son might be in love with this guy, and his troops might be in love with him, but he still has the love of the people. Next slide. And with tambourines and lyres, as they danced, they sang, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands. Can you imagine that? The whole idea of a king coming back for battle is that you would bring all the prisoners and you would parade them behind you as a sign of your victory, and all the people were commanded to come out into the streets and praise you. It was one more sign of their loyalty and submission to you. And so he was all prepared. He was dressed in his royal garments, and they went down the street, and the people were singing and were joyful, and he thought, this is wonderful. And as he got closer, what he heard was, yeah, Saul, he's slain his thousands, but David, his 10,000s. Now, if you know anything about history, when you're a king and you have gained the respect, or somebody else has gained the respect of the military, and somebody else has gained the respect of the people, and even your family members begin to drift in that direction, you know this, you're not going to be king for very long. Saul was very angry. This refrain displeased him greatly. They have credited David with tens of thousands, he thought, but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom? And from that time on, Saul kept a close eye on David. The next day, an evil spirit from God came forcefully on Saul. He was prophesying in his house while David was playing the lyre, as he usually did. Saul had a spear in his hand, and he hurled at him, saying to himself, I'll pin David to the wall. But David eluded him twice. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with David, but had departed from Saul. I mean, there's the ultimate rejection. Everybody has left you. Your kingdom's in peril. And now, even God is saying, I want nothing to do with you. Now, why? Because Saul had said he wanted nothing to do with God. Saul began to act like he was God. Saul began to turn away from God's divine plan to bless the people of Israel and sought only to curse them and by his leadership to have them slaughtered. And so God withdrew from him. Now, here's a principle I want to share with you this morning. The damage of rejection comes in the elevation of the opinions of others over God's opinions of us. The damage of rejection comes in the elevation of the opinion of others over God's opinion of us. Now, rejection doesn't come because we've elevated others' opinions over us. We'll experience rejection every day. People will literally reject you. It won't be like, I think they rejected me, or I've got some cognitive distortions that aren't true. They really like, no, there are people who will reject you. There are people who just, they don't like you because of your face. They don't like you because of your abilities or lack of abilities. They don't like you because you love God. There will be people who will reject you. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the damage that happens in us because of rejection. The damage that causes us to go and self-medicate or become dependent and trying to win the approval of others. The damage that makes us shrink back and live lesser lives. The damage that keeps us separated from God and trusting in Him. That damage comes with the elevation of the opinions of others over God's opinion of us. And yet what we need to realize is this. What makes that damage possible is because we are looking for the approval of people who are fickle. We are looking for the approval of people who are frail and who are feeble, and they can't even really love themselves or accept themselves. We're looking for the approval of people that didn't even approve of Jesus. I mean, think about it. When Jesus came, he was fully God and fully man, and they cheered him in the beginning. And then later cursed him and screamed and yelled for his death. In John chapter 15, Jesus said, "If they hated me, how much will they hate you?" If you're looking for the approval of this world, and it matters a lot to you. In fact, if you had to be honest, it matters more to you than God. You're going to be a mess. You are going to experience rejection day after day after day after day. When the opinion of God matters more to you than the opinion of others, you won't experience the rejection of this world. You won't experience the damage of the rejection of this world. Why? Because the opinion of God is elevated above the opinion of others. (Clears throat) Dee Brown said that the very definition of shame is when we believe we're not enough. When we believe we don't measure up. And that's easy in this world because rejection is painful and we're sinners. And so when this world says to me, I'm not enough, or when people exclude me because I'm not enough for them, yeah, it triggers me really quickly because I recognize I'm not enough. I'm not smart enough. I'm not funny enough. I'm not handsome enough. I'm not holy enough. I don't know the right people. I don't have enough money. And so when people reject me, why does it cause that part of my brain to experience pain? Because it's real. I get it. I'm not enough, and you exposed it. The difference is Jesus came to take that away. When Jesus came and died on the cross, he made us enough. He took away condemnation and shame, and he replaced it with acceptance. He replaced it with the ability to hold our heads high, to know that we are enough. And no matter what others think or say about us, no matter whether they even seek to exclude us, God has already included us. What do we do with rejection? Easily. We reject it. When we experience rejection, what would God have us to do? He would have us reject it. Because in God's economy and his love for us, rejection doesn't exist. God doesn't reject those Christ died for. God chastens, God disciplines, but he never rejects. Because you are held in the love of Christ, which is covered in the love and the power of God. I came across this letter, I love this, with that whole theme of what do you do with rejection, you reject it. This is a rejection letter apparently it's a real letter. It was written to a Miss Easel. And this is what it says. It's a rejection for a job. Thank you for your letter of July 17th. After careful consideration, I regret to inform you that I am unable to accept your refusal to offer me employment within your firm. This year, I have been particularly fortunate in receiving an unusually large number of rejection letters. With such a varied and promised field of corporate candidates, it is impossible for me to accept all refusal for employment. Despite your company's outstanding qualifications and previous experience in rejecting applicants, I find that your rejection does not meet with my needs at this time. Therefore, I will initiate employment with your firm immediately following graduation. I look forward to seeing you then. Best of luck in rejecting future candidates. It's crazy, right? But what an attitude. That's what God would have us to do. Someone counts you out, just remember, God already counted you in. When someone rejects you, it's God affirming to you that they have nothing for you. And he has something better for you. Every rejection that I've experienced in my life, I can look back now and see if I had gotten acceptance, it would have altered my life and I would have never experienced the great things that I've experienced. But at the time, it felt like rejection. At the time, it didn't feel like that's fair. And yet, looking back now, I see it had to go that way. Because God had something better for me. When someone rejects you, that's God affirming they have nothing for you. And he has something better ahead of you. Why? Because we play to an audience of one. We play to an audience of one. We look for the praise of one. Because it's in that we get experience the power of one to love the many. And that's God's desire. Rejection is a powerful and painful thing if you let it creep in and define you. Because the goal of rejection is to steal your identity away from you and tell you that you're nothing, that you're not enough. It is the philosophy and psychology of scarcity. And God has given us not scarcity, but abundance in life. But it's our job to walk in God's Spirit, to understand that when Christ died on the cross, the deal became sealed. Once for all, forever, you matter to God. He did not send his son to die for nothing. That he has plans for you. They're plans to prosper you, not to harm you. And that whatever happens in your life, God has already ordained that it will be worked to the good for his purposes. And so whatever you experience, you can recognize this might not feel good. But this does not define who I am and the quality of my person. I like the story of a young salesman who became discouraged because he experienced so many rejections. And so he went to an older salesman and had shared his frustration and his dejection. And he said to him, "Why is it that every time I call on someone, I get rejected?" And puzzled, the older salesman looked at him and said, "I've been hit on the head, I've been called dirty names, I've been thrown out of the door, but I've never been rejected." What's the difference? The difference is in what we see and what we understand. You will be hurt. People will withhold from you. People will try to define you. But that's when you need to remember those wonderful words from Paul in Romans 8. If God is for us, who can be against us? If God is for me, I can't even hear you. I can't hear your rejections. If God is for me, I cannot let them stop me. So when you bump up against rejection and you think, "I'm not going to do it. I don't think I could handle one more rejection. I don't think I could handle the pain of knowing I'm not enough." It doesn't exist. Because while you weren't enough, Christ died for you. And that was enough. And he gave you his Spirit that you could do more than enough. And God has already ordained what you will do and how it will turn out. And all you have to do is trust that he's enough, show up, and see how much he loves you by what he does through you. Let's join our hearts in prayer.